Where Murder Meets Mystery contains graphic and explicit content. Listener discretion is advised. Hey, cool friends. Let's take a walk down the street where Murder Meets Mystery, a podcast exploring the murderous, the mysterious, and everything that lies beyond the beyond. I'm Grace.
And I'm Trevor.
Episode 50!
And this is episode 50. 50. 50. 50. 50.
50. 50. 50. 50 yeah. Episodes, cool friends. What the fuck? Hello?
Yeah. Our podcast is old enough in episodes to years as a 50-year-old. I don't know what happens when you turn 50. Nothing happens when you turn 50. If we were state workers, we could retire. Or our podcast could retire.
Our podcast is old enough to receive regular annual prostate exams. Oh, colonoscopies. Yeah. What is it? Colonoscopies.
Yeah, that's... Yeah. Once again, it's a little bit more gender neutral there.
Cute.
Those prostate havers.
Our podcast is ready for colonoscopies and mammograms, if you're looking for the born female equivalent.
Yeah, well, you know what? Our podcast is ready to go see the doctor. So, girlfriends, make sure you have a medical provider and you go see the doctor. Because I haven't been to the doctor in 3 years and I need to go.
I haven't either. I haven't been even before my parents kicked me off of their insurance, or I got kicked off of their insurance. It's not their fault. It's me being.
Yikes. We should go to the doctor.
I literally haven't. We should go together. Podcast from the doctor's office. No, I don't love that idea. Christ on a cracker, man. Episode 50!
Episode 50, cool friends. Grace, tell me about your week.
It was so busy. I am dead inside. But I had a few... It was just busy. There were so many... Like, literally, it was one of those weeks where every single hour was filled with something. So I didn't really get a lot of... Thank God I was working out in the mornings. Otherwise, I would have lost my mind because I've been at my computer for 7 days.
Yeah, you need some time to yourself is what it sounds like.
Well, I've had a lot of time to myself, but I need some time to just zone out and stare at a wall.
Right.
I think that'd be nice.
I see what you mean.
Yeah. What about you, buddy? How was your week?
My week's been good. Got to see my parents this weekend. It was fantastic. It was wonderful. And having a good time at work, having a good time with Scar. All in all, great week.
You guys started Gilmore Girls.
We did start Gilmore Girls. I'm 11 minutes into the first episode, and it is riveting. And I'm looking forward to the next episodes.
I know Scar is excited about it. I would describe it as a heartwarming show. It's just kind of
I'm meeting all the characters now, getting in there.
I was going to say it's just a show, but Scarlett got mad when I said that. She's like, just a show!
It's not just a show. It's a wonderful piece of media. The beginning scene is like Lorelai?
Uh-huh.
Lorelai getting hit on by some dude. And then she goes and tries to get like Rory a cup of coffee, only to come back to the table and the guy's hitting on Rory, and that's
because
she's 16.
Yeah, and I've seen the first episode like several times.
Yeah, so yeah, girlfriends, if you're familiar with Gilmore Girls, that was icky.
That was icky.
But they sure showed him because he was like, "You're a mom, and you're old enough to be a daughter." Or it was a big loser moment.
Way to connect the dots for the audience there, buddy.
Yeah, I hope I made
not
it better.
You. No,
or I
not
hope
you,
I, the I hope I was show. Able to paint the picture in everyone's head.
You know those shows that like insult your intelligence by connecting all the dots verbally, like through dialogue? Like they go, "You mean she's the killer? She's been dead this whole time?" It's like obviously, like, you know what I mean? Like I hate shows.
Yeah,
like
Dora the Explorer.
Correct. What'd you say last week? Dead eyes like Dora.
Yeah. Dora's eyes. Where is my soul?
Oh my god.
Where is my purpose? Can you find it?
Where is my soul? Hey, cool friends, if anyone's applied to grad school, let me know. Because I need a support group already.
You can do it.
Granted, I made it as hard on myself as possible because I basically found out about this program yesterday and the application is due tomorrow.
But you're doing great.
I'm doing great. I'm like almost done.
You are.
I'm almost done with my writing sample, which is supposed to be 15 pages, and I started it yesterday at 9 p.m.
But how many pages do you have?
I've written 10 pages in. Literally. And I just have to finish it. It just says February 1st. It doesn't say the time, so I'm just going to assume the end of tomorrow.
Well, February 1st starts at midnight.
Right. So I'm a little worried that it's actually midnight, but I don't know for sure. So I'm just going to hope, because it doesn't say midnight. Because February 1st technically goes until 11:59, right?
Yeah, that's true.
I should probably assume that it's
midnight. We both agree on that February 2nd is too late.
Right. I should probably, you're right, that I should assume it's midnight, but I'm that would mean that would mean that I have to finish everything.
That would mean that you need to do it soon.
Tonight. And that's very stressful. I mean, I could probably wrap up the writing sample and do my personal statement. And then I'm just waiting on two more recommendations. That's really all I need. I did my transcripts.
Yeah, will your recommendations, do those need to be in by February 1st?
Yeah, everything's by February 1st.
Yeah, I would follow up with your recommendations. You told them that
I literally told them yesterday, and I have two out of the three, and the third one said he would send them to me tonight. So,
Well, cool friends, I don't need to keep tabs on Grace. She sounds like she's got it, but also like
I have a list.
Yeah, you're gonna be fine. You can do it.
I'm gonna be fine, and I'm only gonna have three heart attacks, and I'll be okay. So, next episode is live from the emergency room.
Grace, no.
Codes.
No. Go ahead and chew some baby aspirin.
Elevate your arms. Okay. Yeah. Anyway. So, episode 50, we decided to honor our one and only request from our fans, which comes from a very special ghoul friend, Marissa. Thanks,
very
Marissa.
Very special. Yeah, thanks, Marissa. And what is her request? What are we doing?
So Marissa has requested a switcheroo.
Wherein,
suddenly I'm a prosecutor. Wherein. Heretofore.
Insert Forensic Files voice. Wherein.
wherein Trevor does the murder. Trevor commits a murder live on the podcast.
Yeah, and I try to get away with it.
If it weren't for those meddling kids, and then those meddling ghoul friends, and then I will do the mystery. And this is actually very exciting because this is a mystery that I was shocked that Marissa never covered, but I've heard a lot about it and I've always wanted to cover it. So I was also shocked that you didn't cover it. I should have said that too.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm passing the baton of the mysteries to you, and you're passing the torch of the murders to me.
The knife. I'm passing the knife.
Yes. Well, in true where murder meets mystery fashion, that means the murders have to go first. So that means I get to go first this time, girlfriends. So buckle up.
All right. Buckle up.
Let's go. All right. So I'm going to get right into it. And you know me, I like to go international with my murders, and there's typically more than one.
Yep.
So, but I like international.
You love a Japanese crime, is it Japan?
Yeah, or Asian crimes in general. Because they're international, and it's just not something you really hear about in the States, because they're not talked about or covered. You never know what happens over there until, you find out.
I don't think I've ever covered an international mystery. I've never covered an international mystery.
Maybe you should.
I should. It's a lot harder to research those. That's my excuse.
Yeah.
but well, I'm sure you did fine. Go for it.
I'm sure I will do fine. Thanks. Okay, so my mystery is going to... I mean, not my mystery. Whoops.
Fuck.
That's muscle memory. But leave it in. My murder case... It takes us all the way to South Korea.
Ooh, okay.
Specifically Seoul or Seoul. Seoul. I think I'm just going to stick with Seoul, which is the capital of South Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And other little fun facts. It has a population of 26 million and is ranked as the fifth largest metropolitan area in the world.
Whoa.
So just in case you wanted to know what kind of place we're going to, it's like, it's a big region, there's a big metropolitan area, and then there's also like kind of rural suburbs around as well. Seoul, as the, I have it in my notes, it's the Gyeonggi-do, which is the region that Seoul's in. That whole region is like a huge mix of all different kinds of areas, but the metropolitan area is a big portion of it. Kind of like how counties are in the U.S. Like if you live in a certain city's county, then that county is going to be way bigger. Yeah, but if you know a rural or a coastal county without a city, and it's going to be kind of like, you know, like bumfuck.
Right, boofoo.
Yeah, as a technical term. But yeah, today's murder case is widely known in South Korea. But as with most murders outside the U.S., not many Americans know about it, so I'm happy to cover the serial killer who is Kang Ho-sun.
Kang Ho-sun. Wow. Mm-hmm.
And he is who I will be talking about today. And just to give you an idea of the kind of knucklehead this guy was, he is known, which, you know, we don't necessarily like names of serial killers because
right.
kind of glorifies them, but...
Yes.
He is known as the Ted Bundy of South Korea because of the similar similar means in which he was able to manipulate people.
And because Americans have no understanding of foreign... Americans have no understanding of foreign things without a Eurocentric frame of reference. It's fine. That's what's happening. They're like, the only way to make Americans understand things that are happening in other countries is by comparing things that... into things that happened in our country.
Right, and they're similar, and Ted Bundy's just something that people know without having to write a whole, like, one-page description of all the things that, you know, compare
But they
contrast.
Probably don't, like, in South Korea, what I'm saying is, in South Korea, they probably don't call him the Ted Bundy of South Korea.
He's no. Just, no. And in South Korea, I doubt they talk about him much because they don't like to talk about stuff like this. I feel like the United States, or Americans kind of not fetishize the true crime stuff, but I don't know. It's super interesting. It's interesting and yeah, definitely sensationalized a lot of the coverage of stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Which is, I think, part of the problem. But anyway.
So Ted Bundy of South Korea because of his ability to manipulate people, you said?
Yeah. And we can compare and contrast as I get into some more of the details, but at the end of this, that'd be a good question to see how Ted Bundy, like he really seems. Cause there are some similarities and definitely some differences, but I'll be referring to him as Ho-sun because I think that's how you do it. Refer to them in their last name. But anyway, Ho-sun lived in the outskirts of Seoul, but still in the region of Gyeonggi-do? I can't say it. It's Gyeonggi-do, which is the province that Seoul is located, or the region.
Yeah.
It's basically like a mix of rural and suburban areas in which he lived. He didn't necessarily live in the city, but he also moves around, and we'll get into that pretty quickly, so... Ho-sun grew up quietly in a quiet rural family and was the third of five children. And as many students in the area or kids in the area, he attended an agricultural high school where he learned farming techniques. So, you know, kind of think like a vocational high school, more or less.
Yeah.
And for the area which he was in, that was a big, so they had mainly were doing farming. There wasn't a lot of industry there other than the agricultural industry.
Is that the same thing as a trade school?
Maybe, but for this rural area, maybe that's all that they wanted to cultivate because they wanted to keep people in the area.
I remember there was this vocational trade school.
I'm not sure.
He left my high school to go to a vocational school. I'm like, sick. He gets to go on vacation. I literally was like, that's what I thought.
Vacation school?
Vacational.
It's just a cruise ship comes picks you up in the Bahamas. For 3 months.
Cruise ship, like Sweet Life on Deck, motherfucker. That's what he's doing. Okay. Anyway,
that would be pretty sweet.
Yeah. Totally.
It'd be the sweet life.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's why they pay us $3.
Yeah. His farming techniques will come into play later, but he was otherwise a decent student. I mean, he wasn't top of his class, but he did graduate. But Hosun's teachers described him as having a neat appearance and a sincere disposition, and they saw no indication of what he could be capable of in the future. Seemed like a pretty normal kid.
Very Bundy.
He graduated from high school and didn't want to work in the local area, so he didn't do much other than work for his parents after graduating. Hosun grew too tired of working for his parents, so he decided, all right, I'm going to join the South Korean military. So he did. He took on the role of a non-commissioned officer, where he was authorized to do work for the military, but wasn't authorized to like lead or govern enlisted personnel. So it's kind of like he's just kind of like an NCO, which isn't, yeah. I don't know. It's kind of complicated, but I think enlisted personnel. Officer? Yeah, they just don't officer. They don't get commissioned to do any like leading or work with authority or something. I'm not sure.
Okay.
Kind of like the backbone of all military.
I gotcha.
But like the grunt work stuff. His role in the South Korean military was brief because he was dishonorably discharged after he was caught trying to steal cattle while he was on vacation. So, in true country war fashion.
I have read that a lot of serial killers, like, that's one of the common... They commit a lot of petty misdemeanors because they're kind of testing the bounds of it. And I think that theft is one of them.
Yeah, well, this wasn't like a... there wasn't like a string of these things, but I imagine he might have been stealing cattle the whole time. I don't know. But he did get caught, and then he was dishonorably discharged. And he was discharged 2 years after joining. So he spent like a 2-year stint, kind of a short stay in the military. So while he was working with several companies and bouncing from job to job, he met his first wife.
Aww.
Emphasis on first wife. They were 22 years old at the time they got married. And not long after, they had 2 children together.
22?
He had met her like a month for 2 months, immediately marries her quick, and they were 22 years old trying to make ends meet. They got pretty quickly pregnant with their first child, and then they got one on the way.
Well, I mean, inflation is a bitch. I mean, like, I was just talking to a friend the other day, and he was saying like how his dad raised a family of 5 on $53,000 a year, and that shit flew in the 90s. It was tight, but you could do that.
Yeah. In that same vein, while his first wife was with child for the second time, so pregnant with their second child, a lot of times their neighbors would hear them fighting over the responsibility and the exhaustion of raising 2 children, or pretty soon having to raise 2 children because one child was already quite a challenge. And these arguments are what led to the couple, Hosun and his first wife, filing for divorce in 1998, shortly after the birth of their second son.
Okay.
So they filed for divorce. They divorced shortly after, you know, the wife has a newborn.
It was shortly after their marriage, right? I mean, they've only been married for 5 years.
Yeah, I mean, it seems long enough to have a kid and one on the way. So, probably...
It could be 2 years.
Could have been real quick, which it seems like for the timeline that it was actually really quickly. So, may have only been 2 or 3, which is quick in my mind.
Yeah, for sure.
That's his whole shebang. It's just to marry quick and get pregnant quicker.
As in she bang? Is that what you're referring to?
I mean, he bang. They bang.
Okay.
Anyway. At least twice. But anyway, they filed for divorce in 1998, shortly after the birth of their second son, which is the crazy part about that is after the divorce, some ruling or just maybe with what happens, I'm not sure if his first wife had a means to support him and the children. So as a result of that, Ho-sun wanted to move away from his small town and take his two sons with him, because apparently he had custody of his two sons. So everywhere he went, his two sons went with him. So now you have a single father moving out with like a 1 or 2 year old and then a fresh newborn child. Like, I don't even know how that really works.
I hate, like, when you say the fresh ones. I don't like
fresh. A newborn child. I don't ever need to say fresh, right?
No, it's just newborn. Fresh is unnecessary.
So he moved him and his two sons to a small town outside Seoul called Ibongmyeon. I think he did good on that one.
Okay, good.
Ibongmyeon. It's kind of fun to say. Hey, yo, girl, why don't you bibong me on?
Why do we always
say, I'm sorry to every Korean. I'm sorry to every Korean out here.
Please, I am sorry as well.
Ho-sung wanted a new life for his sons and for them to be raised in the city. Soon after he moved to this new city that's closer to Seoul, he fell in love again with another woman. And you guessed it, he married her soon after they met. So we're on wife number two, and you guessed it, they soon became pregnant with their first child together, right what after getting married.
I don't remember. They just
she just kind of peaced out.
Uh huh. Okay.
I don't know if there's visitation. It didn't really say much about it.
But no one's asking questions about the first wife.
No, first wife got out of there when she could, I guess.
Okay, she good.
Yeah, so, and you know, they got pregnant with their first child, him and his second wife, and you can kind of see where this is going, right? Ho-sun and his second wife began to have the same arguments that he and his first wife had, and to add to the frustrations, now Ho-sun had to work overtime to support his growing family, to which he greatly despised having to work more and not make enough money to pay for all the things. Frustrated, it seems like it's very one-income household. As well as now he's got four mouths to feed, potentially, after she has her child, or their child. So what did he do? He decided to divorce his second pregnant wife. Or his pregnant second wife? Pregnant second wife.
His wife, comma, pregnant second.
So, you know, divorced his second wife and was like, I'm taking my sons and I'm out. So I'm going to go... peace out. However, this time he realized that he needed to find more sustainable work and like work on himself and really do some like soul searching. And so, you know, as any good country boy would, he moved 10 miles north and purchased himself a farm, which will be where the setting of today's cases will take place.
Oh, okay.
So he bought himself a farm. And Ho-sun became a farmer with cattle, several pigs and chickens. He was also a beekeeper and made it a habit of his to pick up stray dogs around the area whenever he came across one. However, it's not as innocent as it may seem. Ho-sun had no problem killing livestock, and he would get progressively more and more dark in which methods he used to kill them. Unfortunately, much like the livestock, the stray dogs also shared the inhumane and dark fate. Here's a famous picture of Ho-sun. Pull it up on the drive.
Okay.
Trigger warning. Yeah.
Yeah, what is that? So, what am I looking at?
It's a picture of him with a Siberian Husky. And there's another picture taken by Ho-sun, which I can't show you, wearing blue gloves. And it's detailing the process of slaughtering the Husky to eat it. And much like all serial killers, he kind of got his start on all of his animals that he had in his farm. Many animals became his victims while he operated the farm. However, like many serial killers, he practiced this his craft basically on the animals in his care. The farm, even though he was, like, you know, killing the animals in terrible ways, it managed to support Hosun well enough that he felt like he had found a sustainable lifestyle. Because honestly, he's slaughtering these cattle and everything. He's selling the meat. Even though he's, like, killing them, you know, inhumanely.
Is he selling the dog meat?
I don't know.
Are the dogs for himself?
I wish I could ask him.
I don't.
Yeah, never mind. In the early 2000s, Hosun also managed to find another woman to marry he had his farm. Luckily, this marriage didn't yield any children. For the children. However, the couple would also argue frequently, which resulted in divorce number 3.
Okay. And they're very quick to marry and very quick to divorce.
Huh?
They're always arguing about the same thing, you said, right?
Yeah, just like having to make ends meet, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
This was also a caveat.
Yeah.
I guess so. The other thing was the third wife also found that Hosun's youngest son was like unbearable and wild and just like kind of like his children were just not good.
So
probably because they were being raised by their father, who's like not good.
His youngest son from his second marriage, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So he has 3 sons now. He has 2 sons from his first marriage, 1 from his second, and now this one is not resulting in any children.
I'm pretty sure.
Okay. There's no way to
He's got some amount of sons. But it's not that important. Hosun was miserable with his love life. And he became very miserable because of all of the many divorces. He began to also resent women. So he blamed the women before him.
Yep.
He had hated his former wives for divorcing him and leaving him to raise his sons all on his own.
Yeah.
So he began to, you know, start the woman hating club pretty hard.
Awesome.
What do you think happened?
Well, he killed someone. Otherwise, what are we doing here?
No, he managed to meet his 4th wife, Hei Jin. You know, if I'm mentioning the name. Hey, but you know, it's not all doom and gloom. And honestly, although he had a distorted view on women, he somehow managed Hei Jin to marry him.
Okay.
So 4th wife. I would say that his distorted view on women, I wouldn't say that Hosun was an irritable, like, incel guy. He was collectively described as charming and sociable. He's also described as being able to smooth talk his way out of a bad situation and being able to talk his way into good situations.
Mm.
Master manipulator vibes?
Yeah, I think that part ventures a little bit away from Bundy because he was always nice and charming and grew up in a relatively privileged background. So, like, he was able to... That's what I think actually adds a compelling aspect to his crimes and why it's such a investigated case is, one, people think he's hot. I don't understand that because his fucking unibrow, like, is an abomination. Also, he's an abomination. It's worth adding. Also, yeah. The fact that he grew up in a relatively normal background and theoretically could have had interest from women. Like, he's not a bad looking guy, and he was charming and had a good job and all those things. So, like, for him to then also pursue those crimes, like, that's very unusual. And he actually breaks a lot of the rules as far as serial killers go. Because he's because, like, even Edmund Kemper, like, all his rage was based on his mother and, like, how he hated
his mother. I just think Bundy, I guess, just viewed them, or a lot of people, as just disposable. It was very more like a psychopath or sociopath. Which one?
I would classify him as a psychopath because he's calculating and socially he's like very socially well adapted. Whereas a sociopath typically is on the outskirts of society.
Yeah,
and has low intelligence, low social skills.
With Ho-sun at this point, I think he values marriage, oddly enough, because it's like the first checkbox on his thing after he meets a woman, even though he has so many divorces. I think that's a big thing for him. The other thing I think is because he grew up, I don't necessarily think he grew up poor, but he definitely didn't have the same upbringing as Bundy, for sure. And being from the rural area and like a farming area like that, I think he had a lot of things with money in the beginning. Like that's what most of their arguments were about, is how, you know.
And growing up poor can foster that kind of resentment, you know.
Right.
And he may have resented both his parents, but typically that rage, you know, manifests against the opposite sex parent. So in his case, against his mother, which then is mirrored in his hatred of women, and then further rejections just add to that. And I think also something worth noting about him is the fact that he has such difficulty keeping these marriages is indicative of like a lack of social graces or lack of social skill. Because if someone is socially well adapted, I'm not saying it's 100% guarantee their marriage is going to succeed, because we all have flaws and we all err socially. But I think that if he has that many failed marriages, unless he's self-sabotaging, which is possible, I think that he just doesn't have the social skills to maintain a healthy romantic connection, which is consistent with sociopaths.
We'll see how he further turns out, because he's kind of in this like he's been hurting animals, but he's in this pre-hurting humans moment that we're gonna see kind of unfold here in the next. So I kind of see a tipping point here, and I'd be interested in see what you think about it. But in order to do so, we got to talk about his fourth wife, because she was a business owner, and things actually went pretty well with this lady. She owned and managed a massage parlor where they specialized in Thai and sport massages.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I said that nasty. Did. Massages. Yeah.
Massages.
Yeah, so
you said
emphasis
massages.
On the owned and managed. She kind of had a bunch of massage givers. She had a bunch of employees that then gave
a
the
bunch
massages.
Of
she
pleasure,
just owned and
pleasure
operated
givers.
It.
Pleasure givers.
It wasn't implied in anything that I had read. So it seems like I think everyone here is like doing some good massages. Like
I don't know. Whenever you're telling me that some woman owns a massage parlor, I'm like,
It's also a different culture too, so I feel like that's massages true. Are more of a Korean thing as well.
Yeah, okay.
So Ho-sun found the fact that Hae-jin owned her own business attractive and began to also help at the massage parlor. He began to also help at the massage parlor after he was done at the farm. So he finished his farm duties, and he was so enthralled that she had another business that he wanted to help out and continue to make the business grow. The couple were very happy and things seemed to be going very well until October of 2005, when tragedy struck. On the 30th of October 2005, Ho-sun was at his farm, when his wife, Hae-jin, left the farm and was visiting her mother for tea at her mother's house. Hae-jin's mother's house erupted into flames when they were sitting down to tea. The house burned very quickly, and the room that was engulfed in flames and the room that burned the fastest was the room in which the two women were in. And with no time to escape, the two women were trapped and died in the blaze.
Wow.
After being called to the scene by Hae-jin's family, Ho-sun seemed weirdly calm about his loved ones being burned alive and very unemotional, which they thought is odd.
Weirdly calm, yeah.
An investigation into the cause of the fire was launched, but the results ruled the fire as accidental initially. Hae-jin's family did not believe the results and spurred on a six-month investigation into the cause of the fire, which yielded the same result, accidental, because they found no new evidence for it to be of foul play or any new hard evidence that could prove otherwise accidental. However, because it was ruled accidental, the next year after his wife's death, Ho's son began to spiral out of control, partly because of the death of his wife, partly just because, I don't know, I feel like he had a good thing going with his wife. I don't know, but he started to spiral out of control. This led him to kill as many as 50 dogs and even more livestock at the farm. However, the animal cruelty didn't quench his thirst for carnage. Ho's son's darkest fantasies and thoughts led him to set his sights on another prey. Humans.
Humans. Yeah.
He would stalk the streets of Seoul in his car looking for women who needed a ride. One such woman was a county office employee who was on her way to work. Ho's son knew that he had an innocent look about him and a sincere disposition, back to his teachers, and he planned to use that to leverage the women to get into his car.
Okay.
He would offer the woman who was on her way to work a ride, and she agreed to get in the car based upon, you know, he seemed like a good guy. He's like, "Do you want to ride to work?" And she was like, "Sure, we'll do it." And she soon realized that they were traveling in the opposite direction. Ho-sun then drove the woman out into the woods.
I hate Ubers.
Go ahead. Ubers are
honestly. I was going to say I hate Ubers.
I feel uncomfortable in Ubers. Yeah. Even when I'm with someone.
No. And even with cabs, like, I'm questioned. But at least cabs are like, it's owned by a company. Like, Ubers are just like, it's a company, but it's this person's car. And like, I don't know. It just freaks me out.
Well, unlike all the Ubers that we'll ever have, Ho-sun drove the woman out into the woods where he assaulted her and strangled her to death with her own stockings. Throughout this murder, Ho-sun was calm and collected enough to remove the fingertips of the woman to prevent his DNA from being collected.
Remove them? Like cut her skin?
Yeah, just like cut them off.
What does that mean? Oh.
Cut the tips of her fingers off.
Oh.
He buried the woman in the woods outside of his farm and returned home to pretend like nothing had ever happened. And he was listening to his police surveillance radio. And after a couple months of him deciding to lay low, he decided that it had almost been like a year and a half since his wife died. So he was like, time to collect on that insurance policy. And he collected her insurance policy of $500,000.
No, isn't there a limit of, like, a statute of limitations, I guess, is the equivalent of what I'm trying to say? Like, there's a time limit in which you can receive the payout.
I'm sure there were certain rules regarding his life or her life insurance policy that he had to abide by as well. So I'm not sure what that was. But he originally didn't claim the money for a while. Who knows why? Sometimes when people claim it right away, you can kind of see a motive. Maybe he was trying to play it off for the arson and attempted murder or whatever, and the murder of his mother-in-law.
So his fourth wife was the one who was killed in the fire.
Correct. After he claimed the insurance policy, he continued to stalk and murder women, oftentimes visiting the local Seoul karaoke bars to convince the staff to come home with him. In the karaoke bars in Seoul, the owners will often pay the waitresses to flirt with the employees to try to keep them there and make sure that they have a good time, as well as keep them drinking and, you know, serving them drinks and stuff. And they're not specifically trying to push other services onto their patrons, but that's up to the discretion of the hostesses that are there, so they can sort of engage in like prostitution and stuff as that goes, as well as, or if they really meet a guy that they really like, they can go home with him and do whatever they want. But oftentimes that's kind of something that they do in karaoke bars, which is like a weird sex trade kind of thing. But within that context, the women that he was preying upon in those situations were women who were, you know, either in the sex trade, this marginalized group of women that he sort of targeted over the next couple years. Other times he would pick up women on the streets that needed rides. The spree continued for 2 years, where he would kill 9 women during those years until 2009, in which December 2008, Hosun murdered a university student who was also the youngest of all his victims. Her disappearance went on for days, weeks, and then months, which led her family to file her as a missing person. This was the first missing persons report that I'm aware of. I don't know why other people didn't file for missing persons, but they just didn't. They told police that she took the same bus to class every morning because she was a university student, and that it was the same bus stop. Aww. Luckily, the bus stop that she frequented had installed security cameras 2 months prior to her disappearance, and they were able to capture Hosun picking her up in a van at the bus stop, which is good. They weren't exactly able to see him, but they also they have a car, okay, and they have who that car is linked to. Also, Hosun had become more and more cocky and reckless and used the woman's information to withdraw money from an ATM, in which the ATM was able to capture footage of Hosun withdrawing money from her account. Boom, we got his face.
Right.
Soon after that, on January 29th, 2009, the police had enough evidence. They knew it was Hosun, and so they raided his farm and captured him.
Hmm.
So now he's in custody. The farm was seized for an investigation while officers on the property were on the property. They had found evidence for the murder of all the women he had killed previously. An obvious piece of evidence were the charred, burned out remains of 2 vehicles, one of which was the van he used to pick up women around Seoul. In Hosun's house, the investigators found bloodstained women's clothes and outfits. And that's also where they found a lot of the data that linked him to the other women. And upon questioning,
like Robert Picton.
Well, his trophies were definitely like bloodstained clothes and other things like that. So,
well, just like the farm, like, and the
parts in the freezer or anything.
No, but like the farm and the livestock and the sex workers, it's very similar.
Yeah, yeah. No, I feel like there's more similarities to Robert Picton than there are Bundy in some ways.
Yeah.
Other than like the him just being innocent looking.
Well, that's one thing about Bundy. Bundy is like, a lot of his victims were high risk victims. They were like college girls, teenagers that like would very easily go. He wasn't picking up runaways like Manson was, you know?
Right.
Like he was.
People whose families would notice their disappearance.
Right. And they did. Yeah. And these were, that's why it gained such national coverage so quickly. Was because all these women were being reported missing. I should say girls. They were teenagers. Yeah.
Right.
So anyway, yeah, I think that's the difference here so far that I'm noticing is the risk involved in taking certain victims. And it sounds like Hosun didn't take as much of a risk. He was taking women who wouldn't be missed, to put it crudely.
Yeah, up until probably the murder that got him caught. I feel like he had a quarry, but I think he messed up. He started getting naive, reckless, cocky, and just started, I don't know, doing whatever. Maybe he felt more and more invincible, powerful, something.
What I've learned in reading about serial killers and all of this stuff is like, the one that gets them caught is typically the one that breaks the pattern.
Yeah.
And it was the same with Bundy. I'll use that as an example again. He exclusively targeted like late teenage girls with brown hair parted down the middle. And then he crossed the country, and his crime that got him caught was he killed a bunch of blonde sorority girls in South Florida. In one house. It was like a super big escalation in the violence of his crimes. And I think that was what got him caught. So I'm not saying that's like foolproof every time that's what's happening, but like it's pretty common that they deviate from the pattern in some way, and that's what gets them caught.
Nah, definitely. It seems like a trend for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So upon questioning, and after the mountain of evidence that was revealed to Hosun, he confessed to the murders of the women whose DNA was found on his property, which was all of the women. During his trial, he had decided to plead not guilty for some reason, even though he confessed to the murders. I'm not exactly sure. I don't know if it was a deal or not, because it seems like it was just kind of defiant, like he wanted to plead not guilty and be tried instead of just plead guilty and less stuff have to be stacked up based upon his confession. I don't know. Maybe it was a last ditch effort. But then again, whenever he had led police, so they had taken him out to the farm so that he could show them where the bodies are, because that's what he agreed to, show them where everyone was buried. And as he was doing it, he almost was like very like aloof and whimsical and like very like weird about like, oh yeah, they're right over here, this is exactly where I did it, I remember it like it was yesterday, kind of weird vibes about it. And so I wonder if that kind of carried over into his trial, the weird like pride or some sort of delight that he had. But he was found to be guilty of all the murders, as well as the arson and murder of his fourth wife and her mother. So they went ahead and pinned that on him. I don't know if they found more evidence, or they just were like, this guy's crazy, he probably killed them too.
That's a pretty big win. Usually with serial crimes, like, they are only convicted of like 7 or whatever, because that's enough to get a life sentence.
Right. And
unless you're Robert Picton and you can file for appeal.
Yeah, lame. 2027.
Ugh.
But luckily, Kang Ho-sun was sentenced to death in April 2009. However, due to the last execution in South Korea being 1997, he's been locked up behind bars until they decide to restart the executions. So he's going to stay behind bars until they decide to carry forth with like the lethal injections or hangings or whatever they decide to do. Because in 1997, the last execution was a hanging.
That's very antiquated.
Yeah, super wild. But anyway, he's still behind bars today, I think. I think he's still alive. I'm not sure. But either way, he's incarcerated till he dies.
Wow.
It's weird. And you're going to notice how I didn't really talk very much about the victims as far as names.
Yeah.
The problem with that is South Korea protects the victims of crimes in a strict confidential way, which I think that's good. But they failed to protect the name of Kang Ho-sun, and they also failed to they had a big thing where they don't want to show people's faces in a means to like not publicize things and make a spectacle of things. But in the way of that, it's like hard to properly remember the 10 women whose lives were taken away too early. We don't have very many names other than Hae-jin and her mom, who became victim to this guy. And even though that Ho-sun saw these women as objects, they were far from it. To many, they were a daughter, a sister, a mother, a friend, an aunt. And Ho-sun's case, you know, it's good because it reminds us to always proceed with caution around people you don't know, no matter what they look like, and to take steps to ensure that we're being safe in public and in Ubers. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, just always got that thing on you in Ubers.
Yeah. And raise your
stay strapped, to, like, friends.
Respect women. That too.
Yeah.
You know? Raising everyone to respect everyone and look out for themselves and each other. Yeah. It's just, to me, it's
see something, say something. Don't just let it go unnoticed.
Yeah, exactly. Wow.
Well, that's my case. I mean, my case.
Very depressing story.
Yeah.
All I'm saying, girlfriends, friends, is it's dark stuff. Give yourself a little detox, you know, take care of yourself.
With Grace's mystery.
Yes, my mystery, which is, I would say, spooky, but it's also eerie, and I've got some history that I know Trevor especially will appreciate it. You are 90% of the reason why I put this in there, because it's not super relevant, but I thought it was really interesting, so I put it in there. So, for my mystery, that's fun to say, cool friends, we are traveling all the way to San Jose, California. to the infamous Winchester Mystery House.
Ooh.
Okay.
Spooky house.
Although the house is located on the West Coast, our story actually starts in the East. The only thing this is not is a cryptid. There's like some conspiracy, some haunting, but there's no cryptids involved. That's the one thing I did not cover. But I did a little double dip. Did a little double dip.
Okay. Did a little double dip.
Did a little double dip. So our story actually starts in the East. By the way, I know that almost all of this history lesson I'm about to give you is not relevant to the, it's related, but it's not, it's related in that it's in the same vein and it involves some of the same people, but it's not like super related. I just found it really interesting. So mind your own business. In 1848, two businessmen / inventors named Horace Smith and Daniel Wesson forged a partnership in Norwich, Connecticut. Horace and Daniel, who took a particular interest in firearms.
Smith and Wesson.
Yep. Acquired the technology for an improved version of the Volition repeating rifle, invented in 1848 along with the caseless rocket ball ammunition. The design belonged to an inventor named Lewis Jennings, who originally sold his design to a company named Robbins and Lawrence. The weapon and its ammunition had been produced in small numbers in Vermont, but the rifle was a commercial failure, so Robbins and Lawrence ceased production in 1852. So, for those of you ghoul friends, not gun-toting ghoul friends, Smith & Wesson is a firearm company, right? Manufacturer?
Yep, it's a modern firearm company that had its beginnings in probably back around this time.
Yeah, so Smith & Wesson are the same Smith & Wesson who established this company, but they're not really the main characters. They're important in understanding the next member of the story, but they don't found. Yeah, they don't found Smith & Wesson until later. Yeah, so we're talking about the rise to fame of Oliver Winchester, who's the founder of Winchester, the Winchester Rifle Company. So we're going to talk about that. But I've got to go
design the Winchester repeater, right?
And the whole concept was that you could fire without having to like clean the gun in between shots, like a musket, right?
Right.
The idea was that you could fire many shots quickly, and that was not something that existed.
Correct.
The weapon and its ammunition had been produced in small numbers in Vermont, but the rifle was a commercial failure, so Robbins and Lawrence ceased production of it in 1852. Horace Smith, seeing a gap in the market, designed a much improved rifle based on Jennings' original design, and Smith & Wesson, who would later go on to found the famous Smith & Wesson Revolver Company, incorporated as the Volcanic Repeating Arms Company, seeking investors to manufacture what they called the Volcanic Lever Action Rifle and Pistol. Their largest stockholder was a man who worked in clothing design and manufacturing named Oliver Winchester. So he actually wasn't even working in firearms. This is kind of like
the story. He just had a manufacturing plant.
Yeah, but he was a successful businessman, very wealthy on his own, and he was the largest stockholder in this company. With limited success.
Nothing better than a Volcanic as a, a brand. Yeah. The Volcanic Smith & Wesson repeater. Crazy.
Yeah. Oliver Winchester and his partner, John M. Davies, purchased the bankrupt firm's assets and reorganized it as the New Haven Arms Company in April 1857. After Horace Smith left the company, the recently fired foreman from the original manufacturer, a man named Benjamin Henry, worked on the project, eventually perfecting the much larger, more powerful 44 Henry round. He also supervised the design of a new rifle based loosely on the Volcanic, and this became the Henry rifle of 1860, manufactured by Winchester's company and used in considerable numbers by the Union Army in the American Civil War.
Yep.
Our boy Benjamin was not satisfied, okay? He did not believe he was being adequately compensated for his genius. So he actually petitioned the Connecticut legislature to transfer the ownership of the New Haven Rifle Company, New Haven Arms Company, excuse me, to him, okay? Ollie Winchester said, Ollie. bitch, you thought, and reorganized the company again, this time as the Winchester Repeating Arms Company. Quote, Winchester had the basic design of the Henry rifle completely modified and improved to become the first Winchester rifle, the model 1866, which fired the same 44 caliber rimfire cartridges as the Henry, but had an improved magazine with the addition of a loading gate on the right side of the receiver invented by Winchester employee Nelson King, and for the first time, a wooden fore-end. Fore-end?
Fore-end. Yeah, fore-end.
Winchester manufactured another popular model in 1873, which introduced the first Winchester centerfire cartridge. These rifle families are commonly known as the guns that won the West.
Uh-huh.
That's a very common phrase. Tragedy struck when Oliver's son, William Winchester, good old Willie, William Winchester.
Willie and stood, Ollie.
Yeah, Willie and Ollie. Those were not nicknames they were given, by the way. I just gave them those nicknames myself.
Oh, good.
Tragedy struck when Ollie's son, Willie, who stood to inherit the famed rifle manufacturer's empire, and his wife, Sarah, we'll get to her in a second, lost their infant daughter to a childhood illness. She was only a month, she was less than a month old. Oliver Winchester Tragic. Died several years later in December 1880. Good old Willie did inherit the company and his father's fortune, but he died of tuberculosis just 4 months after the death of his father. Now, I told you that William's wife, Sarah, is important here, major main character energy, and she is the moment, ghoul friends, let me tell you. Sarah Winchester, nicknamed Sally, was born in New Haven, Connecticut in 1839. She married William in 1862. In 1866, Sarah gave birth to a girl named Annie Pardee Winchester. This is the same daughter who was diagnosed with marasmus. Annie lived only a month before succumbing to her illness. Between the fall of 1880 and the spring of 1881, Winchester's mother, father-in-law, and husband died. She was left with a significant inheritance from her husband. Following these subsequent tragedies, Sarah Winchester left New Haven and moved to San Jose, California. Upon her arrival, quote, she bought an 8-room farmhouse with plans to renovate. There's a photo on the drive, photo A.
Photo A.
It's a cutie. Wow.
Little house. I yeah? like it.
And it doesn't say 8-bedroom. It just says 8-room. And so I don't know if that's including the kitchen. I don't know. But it's kind of a cozy farmhouse. It's not massive, right? But she did own a lot of land.
Yeah, it's still pretty.
Yeah, very pretty house. Now, what makes this house a mystery, ghoul friends, you may be asking? Well, legend tells us that when Sarah lost her husband and daughter, she also lost her mind. This house is rumored to be an eerie representation of a woman's descent into madness. Sarah began what could only be described as the world's longest home renovation, stopping only when Sarah would pass away nearly 40 years later in September of 1922. There are some rumors that state that construction happened around the clock without stopping for 38 years, but some sources disagree. All we know for sure is that construction began in 1866 and stopped when Sarah died. There's another photo on the drive of the current house.
Woo.
And tell us what you're thinking, Trev.
Oh, wait a minute. Like the B?
Yeah, photo B. That's one? What the house looks like now.
It looks like she added on 200 rooms.
Yeah. I'm going to tell you.
Like, it's exactly a compound now, girlfriends. Like, it's, yeah, it's like,
fucking
I can't even tell. I can't even tell what the old house, where the old house was.
Yeah.
It's all changed.
I'll give you all the specs in a second, but she basically transformed it into a, like, massive mansion. That's the only way I can describe it. But it all stemmed from that original 8-room farmhouse. From 1886 to 1922, construction seemingly never ceased as the original 8-room farmhouse grew into the world's most unusual and sprawling mansion. When Sarah made the decision to expand, she hired at least 2 architects, but then dismissed them, deciding to plan the entire project herself, designing each room one at a time. She supervised the project and sought advice occasionally from the carpenters she hired. It was unusual for a woman to look after such a project, and Colin Dickey states in his book Ghostland, An American History in Haunted Places, that Sarah could be considered an architectural pioneer of her time. After its completion in 1922, the house was a whopping 24,000 square feet.
Dang.
And featured 10,000 windows, 2,000 doors, 160 rooms, 52 skylights, 47 stairways and fireplaces, 17 chimneys, 13 bathrooms, and 6 kitchens. The entire renovation...
I don't see how she fit all that in there.
I know. The entire renovation would total $5 million in 1923. And I know my hoes love an inflation calculation. So cool, friends. That is $85.5 million today. From Wikipedia, quote, there was carved wood on the ballroom walls and ceilings used to make an intricate pattern on the ballroom floor. A large brick fireplace was framed by two windows that included quotes from Shakespeare. There were chandeliers from Germany, art glass from Austria, furnishings from Asia, and paintings from France. An annunciator, an early form of an intercom, which was a common feature of large homes during this time period, was installed for calling servants. Though, as far as I know, none were ever hired. She lived in this house alone. There existed an indoor garden with slanted floors that would carry excess water to trapdoors, which had pipes that would supply water to the outdoor flowers. A generator was installed for a water pump and electricity. Because of Winchester's height of just 4 feet 10 inches tall and various health issues, including rheumatoid arthritis, a stairway that had 44 steps was invented for her, but it only rose 10 feet tall. I have a picture on the drawing of the
super long stairwell.
Super long. What is it? But no, it's super short, but there are many steps. I don't know how to describe it. Now, some of the eerier features of the home sparked rumors in the late 1800s that Sarah was superstitious, which was controversial at the time. The story goes that these features, including staircases that led to nowhere, there is a photo on the drive. It is features like these that contribute to, quote, the belief that Sarah built her house in its strange maze-like manner to confuse and keep spirits from harming her, and that her sanity was questionable at best.
Wow.
The doors and windows that opened to nothing, the unusually shallow stairs, the stairs that end in a ceiling, interior barred windows and trap doors in the floor are used to confirm Winchester's spirituality and poor state of mind. Doors in the ceiling, floor, and walls that led to walls, like you would open the door and it's just a wall, basically.
Dang.
And this was the same with windows, with trap doors. This was a common theme. And staircases that would wind and they would just hit a wall. It wasn't even going anywhere.
Oh, dang.
The mansion included a bell tower that was used to call workmen and to serve as a fire alarm on the property. According to Joe Nickel, fanciful claims later arose that it was used to summon spirits. According to Joe Nickel, he claims that local residents heard ghostly music coming from the house, and these are explained by the fact that Winchester often played the pump organ in the grand ballroom when she was unable to sleep, and that's on the drive as well.
Love the pump organ.
I love a good pump organ.
I have one of those.
Oh, man.
Hey, yo, girl, want to see this pump organ?
Also, according to Nickel, claims that Winchester held parties for the spirits in her home that featured lavish dishes served on gold plates kept in a safe are fanciful and unsubstantiated. So Nickel does not buy these theories. But it's rumored that she would hold these dinner parties because there were large dishes of platters of food and no one lived in the house but Sarah.
Wild.
So very weird. So she would like cook these elaborate meals. And yeah. Nickel wrote that after her death, when the safe was opened, no gold plates were found, only personal mementos and a lock of her baby's hair.
Oh.
Yeah. Now, I think the money was all spent on the renovation. You know?
Yeah.
I don't know how big her inheritance was, but... Quote, one door opened to a sheer 15-foot drop into an outdoor garden. If you step through another, you will land 8 feet below... 8 feet below into the kitchen sink. Some of the staircases in this home are truly peculiar. Instead of taking you to another floor, they lead you right into the ceiling. Weird.
It's weird.
I touched on one of the rumors that surrounded the house, but here are a few others. One rumor tells us that Sarah, quote, visited a medium in Boston named Adam Coons, who told her that she and her family were being haunted by the ghosts of people killed by Winchester rifles, that she must construct a house for these ghosts, and that she must never complete the project until the day she dies. That gives me chills. Now, I discovered that it was actually common for a woman of her wealth and status to consult with psychics, but there's no evidence to confirm that said meeting ever took place. So we don't know this for sure, but this is one of the rumors. Another rumor, Sarah was haunted by the thousands of ghosts felled by the gun that won the West. One of the most widely accepted theories, the story goes that the invention of the Winchester rifle at the hands of her father-in-law's company, as well as her husband's undeniable and direct involvement in the design and sale of these rifles, irrefutably led to the death of thousands. The question is whether the lost souls might possess the sole survivor of the Winchester legacy, compelling her to build this colossal maze. As the website for the Winchester Mystery House states, quote, what motivated a well-educated socialite to cut herself off from the rest of the world entirely and focus almost solely on building the world's most beautiful yet bizarre mansion? And cut herself off she did. Miss Sarah was the subject of much gossip and controversy because she was a woman who lived alone, owned her own home, and never went out in public. The shock.
Right.
Honestly. Because after the renovation began in 1886, Sarah Winchester was not seen in public. There are only a few known photos of Sarah in front of her home, and one of them is on the drive. You That's almost it. Can't even see her. She's in the carriage. She's sitting in the carriage.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And Barely. This was like towards closer to her death. I think she's in her 60s or 70s in that picture.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Quote, beginning around 1895, Winchester started appearing in newspapers. The articles in these local papers were filled with speculation about Winchester and the ongoing construction of her San Jose home. Her lack of interaction with neighbors and the known fact that her money came from the firearms industry fed into a superstitious narrative, despite large, ornate homes being commonly built by the wealthy. The newspapers declared that the reason that the construction was ongoing was that Winchester feared she would have bad luck if the construction did stop. This theory eventually grew into stories that she believed she would die if construction stopped. So these stories were just becoming more and more fanciful because people can't keep their damn mouths shut.
Yeah, but still, like, the results after the fact, like, after exploring the home, it does seem rather strange. But also, like, all these people that built the house and did these renovations, were they just, how many times did it take, like, a contractor or a carpenter or, like, a architect to come in and be like, why are we doing this? Building a stairwell into the ceiling?
I don't know.
And
I
then mean, I'm, her I, just I waving can only... a wad of cash, like, this is why? And then they're like, all right.
Say less. I can only guess, but I'm assuming it's money related. She just was willing to offer them any amount of money. But she did a lot of the more expensive thing herself, like not necessarily the labor, but the planning and the consultations and all that stuff that costs a pretty penny nowadays.
Yeah, but maybe instead of hanging out with the socialites and stuff and people of her standing and whatever, she just rather hang out with people who worked on her house.
Yeah. I guess.
Maybe but then there aren't very many stories about that.
And as far as we know, she only hired two architects and then decided to plan the whole thing herself. Yeah. And so there's no evidence that she was even interacting with these workers. She may have been alone. I don't know.
She could have been in one corner of the house and probably never saw anyone.
Right. I think what makes this story so sensational and makes Sarah so iconic was she was a woman of independence and was ahead of her time. She had drive and courage, and she lives on in legend. And the mansion she built is world-renowned as much for the many design curiosities and innovations, many ahead of their time as well, as it is for the reported paranormal activity that resides within these walls. This mysterious home and the lore surrounding it are what has drawn over 12 million guests to visit the Winchester Mystery House since the doors opened nearly 100 years ago on June 30th, 1923. So I didn't get a ton into the paranormal stuff because I wanted to talk a little bit more about the house itself. I felt like that was more interesting, but I will kind of talk about some accounts. A very common account is a little girl laughing and what's her name? Lily from the...
Yeah, from the Trans-Allegheny.
Allegheny, yeah. So that's one common account is there's a little girl laughing. But I feel like little girls be laughing in all haunted houses, you know what I mean?
Right, always like... yeah, there's always like a cassette tape or something playing. in the other room.
Some little girl laughing. There's some rumors that there's rumors
MP3. That
the lights flicker, that the organ, the pump organ, begins playing on its own. Yeah.
Man, it does play on its own sometimes.
There are some rumors that the bell tolls at weird times. So you'll hear the bell ringing and there's no one in the tower. Things like that. So yeah. I think that the most paranormal aspect of it to me is like the rumor that she's being compelled by spirits, or that she's, I actually think the most likely story is like, this is totally some psychic shit, you know, spend all your money renovating this house for the rest of your life, and you're never going to be able to finish the project, you know. And yeah,
she woke up and her horoscope said to do that, and she was like, all right.
Yeah. Anyway, that's my mystery. I thought it was really interesting. And,
wow. That was a great mystery.
You enjoyed the gun history and all that?
Yeah, I did. It was great. Happy 50th episode, Grace.
You too, Trev.
Cool friends, we are very, very, very glad that you guys have stuck around for 50 episodes. Here's to 50 more. Raise your glass.
Yeah, unbelievable. And follow us on Instagram at Where Murder Meets Mystery. And Trev, where can they email us?
Shoot us an email at wheremurdermeetsmystery@gmail.com. Send us anything. Tell Grace she's funny. give us episode ideas. I don't know, just anything. We hope that you have an excellent week, girlfriends.
Yes, and we'll talk at you next episode 51. Call your dad.
Heck yeah, call your dad.
Love you, bye.
Bye, girlfriends.